Well, good evening. This is I'm sure many of you are absolutely terrified at what's just happened, because in a remarkably low Anglican moment, we've not had a reading before the sermon. I hope you can get your heads around that. It is intentional, and I'm not about to go off the rails and preach from the Apocrypha or Dickens or Star Wars or something. The reading is coming, but there was a reason for delaying it a little bit. I don't know what kind of hobbies you have. Some of you probably play golf. Some of you, I know, cycle. That's a big thing around here. I only have one hobby. I have a single hobby, and that is I go to the cinema a lot. I go to the cinema probably about 50 or 60 times a year, which may seem excessive to you and is quite antisocial because I usually go on my own. The interesting thing about seeing so many films is you start to see the patterns in all movies or in all screenplays. Because you start to realize there's this formula to all movies. And essentially, terrifying news if you didn't know this already, all films are essentially the same. Forget this idea that there are seven great stories that you can weave. There's literally just one structure for film. And almost everything follows that structure. And I love watching films in totally different genres and seeing how they all conform to the same pattern. So Jaws has the same basic structure as Toy Story. When Harry Met Sally has the same, genuinely the same narrative skeleton to it as Saving Private Ryan. There's these same markers that are through every screenplay. And if you, once you know they're there, it ruins all films for you. And I'm going to do that for you this evening. I'm going to ruin all films for you now. So around about, let me tell you right now, around about 12 or 13 minutes in every movie, sometimes it's 15, sometimes it's 10, but around about that point, there's this catalyst, this moment that instigates the action and gets things going. That happens in every screenplay around that moment. And on a 120-minute movie, it'll always happen around 13 minutes. So look out for it. Look out for the clock on your DVD player or whatever next time you're watching a movie. And then probably most significant among these and always present in every screenplay is this moment screenwriters call the all is lost moment. And this is the moment where the odds suddenly seem insurmountable. So perhaps a key character dies. Actually, usually that does happen. Or a mission apparently fails. Or the lovers say they hate each other and part ways apparently forever. It's Obi-Wan Kenobi dying on the Death Star. Sorry if I'm ruining that for you. It's 1977 in Star Wars. It's. Am I going to ruin La La Land for anyone? Just close your ears. It's Ryan Gosling missing Emma Stone's big show in La La Land. And the reason for that is that writers have discovered through the generations that somehow victory tastes sweeter when it's snatched from the jaws of defeat. We love a redemption story. Our brains are wired to enjoy the almost impossible comeback, the resurrection moment, if you will. We love it when the tables are turned. Look at that. So a couple of recent examples that help me justify all the cinema trips. So this is Rogue One. Hands up if you've seen Rogue One, Star Wars, yeah? Okay, I'm going to ruin it for the rest of you. So this is Jyn Erso, because they have really sensible names in Star Wars. And she and her crack team of space rebels have to steal the plans for the Death Star. And also, she tries to reconnect with her father. And there's this moment called the all is lost moment, about 75 minutes into the movie, where her dad... Am I going to ruin this for anyone? Spoiler alert. Dies. Her dad dies, okay? I'm really sorry. It's been out for 4 months. Her dad dies, and it looks like her mission has become impossible. And yet, if you've seen the end of Rogue One, and probably you've guessed, somehow, against all the odds, the mission succeeds. And then this is a movie called Lion. Has anyone seen Lion? It's an absolutely fantastic Oscar-nominated movie. It's a true story, so I can't spoil this one. And this is the incredible true story of a boy who becomes separated from his family in India, apparently forever. He becomes locked in a train which travels 1,500 kilometers across India when he's 5 years old. And when he gets out at the other end, he doesn't know the name of his village. He doesn't know the name of his parents. And so he's separated from them forever. And when he's grown up, he starts to look for his family and he essentially gives up. And there is again this all is lost moment. There is a moment where he believes categorically he cannot find his family again. But then there's this moment of inspiration and he gets the lead he needs and eventually he reconnects with his family. And then similarly weighty material, the Lego Batman movie. Who's seen that? That's the one you should have seen off this list. This is the best one. So Batman is incredibly proud. And because of Batman's pride, I promise scripture is coming. Batman's pride means that every baddie in history is released into Gotham City at the same time. And he can't possibly defeat them on his own. And he's decided he doesn't need his team. But then, after that all is lost moment, there is redemption. He realizes that no man is an island and he embraces friendship and fatherhood and he forms this team that wins the day. And all kinds of stories follow this structure where all is apparently lost and yet somehow victory is still won. And arguably, that's why so many films chime with the Christian story. But more on that later. All of which is a very long introduction to the biblical book of Esther. And I think, first of all, can I just put my hand out? I don't know if anyone else, I've never really thought very much of the book of Esther. I've always been like, God's not in it. So it's always felt to me like a less important book. I'm really sorry, there are some Esthers in the, I'm sure it's very precious to you, isn't it, Esther Downs? But to me, Esther's always felt like a bit of a light entry in the Bible. Sorry. And actually, having looked at it, I think it's one of the most cinematic stories in the Bible. So you might want to have Esther open because we're going to go through pretty much all of it now. It might be helpful to turn to page 504, it says on my hand, in the church Bibles. And I'm going to recap the first few chapters of Esther for you. So we have Esther 1, which is frankly a bit weird. Queen Vashti decides not to turn up for dinner. She sets a precedent for women having to respect their husbands. But this is, interestingly, if we're going to do screenplays, the inciting incident, the catalyst that drives the action forwards. And this opens up the way for Esther, who's a Jew, to become queen. And in Esther 2, we meet Mordecai, who is a Jew in exile from Jerusalem, who acts as Esther's father and guardian, even though they're only cousins. Although no one knows about that relationship, which is kind of exciting cinematic tension right there. The king falls for, King Xerxes falls for Esther and decides to make her queen. And meanwhile, Mordecai does something heroic. He uncovers a plot against the king, but at the time, he doesn't receive any recognition for it. And that becomes important in a bit. And then in Esther 3, we meet this baddie, the baddie of the story, Haman, who immediately hates Mordecai, and he wants to see the destruction of the Jewish people, which Helen said last week could have been around 10 million people. And he manages to trick King Xerxes into agreeing an edict to kill them all, because they keep themselves separate and serve God ahead of the king. And in Esther 4, as we heard last week, Mordecai learns of what's about to happen, and he persuades Esther that she is her nation's last hope. And he famously tells her that she's been put here in this time, in this place, in this royal position for such a time as this. Now, chapter 5, we start this evening to fill in the next part of the story. And to avoid reading three entire chapters to you now, let me just pre-see the first one for you. So, having met with Mordecai, in chapter 4, Esther goes to visit the king, and he's pleased to see her, and so he calls her over. And so, because he's in an incredibly generous and good mood, he says in verse 3, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be given you." Which, I mean, he really is in a good mood. It's nice. In verse 4, she says, "If it pleases the king, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him." So if this was a film, she might possibly wink at the audience at this moment, because we know Haman is the enemy and we know Esther is up to something. And so the king sees absolutely nothing odd in this. He has no knowledge of the politics. He doesn't know that Esther and Mordecai are related. He doesn't know that Haman is plotting a genocide for Esther's people. So they have a banquet, and Haman, who also doesn't realize that Esther is the enemy, is delighted. And then something weird happens. So in chapter 5. At the banquet, the king asks Esther what it is that she actually wants. And her answer is, bring Haman to yet another banquet tomorrow. I find that odd. I think this is odd, the two banquets thing. But it does allow us to see Haman's character. Because as chapter 5 ends, the action switches to following him on the way home to his wife. And he's feeling pretty smug about the fact that he was the only noble invited to accompany the king to the banquet and then to yet another banquet. But on the way home, he spots Mordecai. And Mordecai, the Jew, refuses to treat him with any respect. And so Haman is enraged and he decides he is going to set up an elaborate death trap for Mordecai, which he'll then put into action the next day. So Haman has a pole set. I mean, this is so Old Testament, it's untrue. Haman has a pole set up to a height of 50 cubits. It's a 22-meter pole on which he's going to drop Mordecai from an even greater height. Now, obviously, Google Images is not your friend at this moment. I looked, but I thought there might be children present at this point, so I'm not going to show you any of those images. So, in fact, I'm going to show you this picture of a cute kitten. As you imagine, the death trap, the 22-meter high death pole of Haman. Now, there's some debate whether this was really the height or whether artistic license is being used. But either way, Haman wants to kill Mordecai on a big pole. And if you've ever seen a James Bond movie, you may be able to guess what's going to happen next. Anyway, he goes to bed feeling very pleased with himself. So the story goes on, and now we pick it up in Esther 6. Okay. Now you get the reading, okay? That night, the king could not sleep. So he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. So this is quite an interesting moment. We see how King Xerxes deals with not being able to sleep. He asks for people to come in and essentially read to him from his own biography. What a character. The strange thing about the book of Esther is that God isn't directly mentioned. But when we see this story through the context of what we know about God and his relationship with the people of Israel and what he might be up to in this story, this doesn't feel like a coincidence. In fact, it's probably the clearest moment where God intervenes, makes an appearance in the book of Esther. He wakes the king and he inspires his massive ego. And at this vital moment, Xerxes learns that it's Mordecai who saved his life all those years ago, back in chapter 2. And suddenly, just at the very moment when we know Haman is planning to have Mordecai impaled, Mordecai gets a trump card. Verse 3. What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. The king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about impaling Mordecai on the pole he had set up for him. His attendants answered, Haman is standing in the court. Bring him in, the king answered, ordered. This is brilliant. It's almost comedy timing. Just as Xerxes has learned of Mordecai's unrewarded heroism, Haman turns up to talk about his big pole. I'll rephrase that. Turns up to talk about the big impaly thing. Verse 6. When Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? I hope you're falling in love with this story as much as I have. This is brilliant screenwriting. So they're talking across purposes. Xerxes has just heard about Mordecai and wants to honor him. Haman appears and naturally assumes, since he's just been invited to all these banquets, that when Xerxes says this, he's talking about him. Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? So he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes, Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Because he thinks it's going to be him. Here comes the punchline. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you've recommended. Fantastic idea. Go and do it. So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. And this is the very definition of through gritted teeth. Haman knows he has to obey the king's every word. But since he's just planned to murder Mordecai and then millions of his people, it is absolutely killing him to do this. You can imagine the false pain smile as Haman has to walk through the streets shouting, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Verse 12. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. The rug has been pulled from under Haman. He's had to honor Mordecai. And now his wife reminds him, this is especially problematic because of his hatred of the Jewish people. What Haman doesn't yet know is that not only is he now up against the king's trusted, beloved Jewish advisor, there's also a Jewish queen related to Mordecai. And so we find ourselves in chapter 7. Which is delightfully entitled, Haman Impaled. In case you hadn't seen that coming. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. And as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king again asked, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life, this is my petition, and spare my people, this is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. This is what the whole thing has all been building up to. This is why Esther wanted all the banquets. Her such a time has come. And she's the only person who is positioned to deliver this news to the one man powerful enough to stop the genocide. And with all deference, she tells him, my people are going to be killed, millions of them. Haman has plotted to wipe out the Jewish race, but just in time, someone has come to the rescue. Verse 5, King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he? Where is he, the man who has dared to do such a thing? You can imagine a massive gulp from Haman at this point. Esther takes a deep breath, and she really chooses her words. Three linguistic blows before she even says his name. Esther said in verse 6, an adversary, an enemy, this vile, dun, 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 Haman! Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Now Xerxes goes into the garden to cool down. He's pretty sure of what he's going to do here, but he goes to cool off. He's conflicted. He's angry at Haman. He loves Esther. He honors Mordecai. But he's also fond of Haman, his most trusted advisor. And he might listen to Esther now if she decides to have mercy. And so rabbis and scholars through the ages think at this point, King Xerxes needed a little push. This is extraordinary. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. So what happens, Haman goes over to the couch where Esther is lying down, and he's remonstrating with her, and he's begging, and then he slips. In fact, Jewish legend has it that the archangel Michael actually shoves him in the back, genuinely, as King Xerxes walks in. It is like a tragic moment from a Carry On film. He falls upon the queen, and doing this is pretty much instant death anyway. But in the context, it's a thing that makes up the king's mind. The king exclaimed, "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" And as soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, "A pole reaching to a height of 50 cubits stands by Haman's house. He had it set up for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king." I mean, no one likes a smart aleck, right? They might have just put Haman to the sword, but then the eunuch pipes up and he has a better idea. He thinks it would be a great moment to bring up the huge pole of impalement that has been conveniently erected, ironically, outside Haman's house. So this great irony is delivered, and Haman will end up being hoisted by his own petard. The king said, "Impale him on it!" So they impaled Haman on the pole that he had set up for Mordecai. And then the king's fury subsided. So after that all is lost moment, where it looked like Mordecai was doomed and all of Israel was under threat of genocide, we get to the point where Haman is dead. The threat to the Jews has been quashed, and in fact in the next chapter it's removed completely. Esther has stepped up for her such a time as this and is a hero, and the unlikely happy ending has arrived. You see how that's quite cinematic? And while God isn't a character in the book of Esther, named with lines of dialogue, we see his hand at work throughout it and throughout this turning of the tables. And there are things we learn about him through this story. He's the one that calls Esther to this moment and gives her access to the only person who can save the Jews, the king. He primes the king to respond to her plan, and he creates tension between the king and Haman. And he even turns up at the end in some way to give the plan a literal final nudge. God is working all the time, silently, invisibly, in the background. In the book of Esther, perhaps that's why this is so relevant to us, because I think it parallels some of our experience of him today. We can't see God, but we believe that he's faithful and that he intervenes as a rescuer in the lives of his people today, not just in ancient stories. Because that is who God is. Over and over and again in the Bible, we see examples of God rescuing his people when all seems lost. These all is lost moments arrive, and then the tables are turned. The Israelites lose all hope after 400 years in slavery, and yet through Moses, he leads them out into the promised land. There are individuals like David, Daniel, David fighting Goliath, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, all basically living with a death sentence and an all is lost moment. And yet God redeems apparently irredeemable situations over and over and over again, because this is the heart of who God is. And perhaps it's no wonder then that so many films, so many stories, so much art that our culture has created follows this same pattern, where the mission is completed against all odds, the lovers are reunited after their breakup, the unlikely victory is won after defeat seems certain. They are all just echoing the big story at the very heart of the universe. And we see that in its very purest form in the Easter story. Jesus dies, and we find ourselves at history's greatest ever all is lost moment. The Son of God who came to save the world is hanging lifeless, dead on a piece of wood. But like all these movies and like the story of Esther, it doesn't end there. 3 days later, he rises from the dead, and in so doing, he opens up the way between man and God forever. That is the ultimate redemption story. That's the ultimate comeback movie. All is lost, and then the tables are turned. That's the story of Jesus. It's the story of Esther. It's the story of humanity. It's our story. I don't know where you find yourself in that particular narrative arc this evening, but you'll be somewhere. And for the rest of this service, and as we celebrate the ultimate comeback with communion, I want to invite you to reflect on where you are in the redemption narrative right now and consider what God might want to say to you tonight.